Daniel Ewan was 16 years old in 2004 when he went missing from Running Springs, California, from his boarding school. The name of the boarding school was SeaDo Running Springs, and it was a therapeutic boarding school known for its tough love approach. It was the last alternative for families who struggled with out-of-control kids. You may have heard the name SeaDo because Paris Hilton brought it to mainstream media when she talked about it in her documentary. She had spent a couple months there and in their sister school. I happened to go to this school. I went there for 2 years and 7 months. I graduated from this school when I was just shy of being 17 years old. I blocked out my experience from the day that I walked off that campus. Recently, and it wasn't even that long ago, I heard that it had been shut down years ago for accusations of abuse and children that had gone missing. When I was at CEDU, we learned that CEDU, spelled C-E-D-U, meant see yourself and do something with it. And we heard that over and over and over, but it wasn't until recently that I heard that those letters actually might have meant Charles E. Diedrich, who was a leader of the Synanon cult. So I had to stop and think, did my childhood end abruptly when I walked onto that campus when I was 13 years old? Did I follow with blind faith and spend my teen years living in a cult? My next guest, I'm so excited to have because I've never met him and I've heard so much about him, is somebody who is a journalist and a podcaster. He had an amazing podcast that when you guys are done listening to this one, you should go on and listen to called The Lost Kids, where he talks about the disappearance of Daniel Ewan and he talks about CEDU. And then his other podcast that is absolutely spectacular is Escaping Nexium, which we will also get into, which is about a self-help group turned into a sex cult. So without further ado, hey there, Josh.
Hello. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Thank you so much for coming. So I wanted to start with, how did you get into being interested in Daniel's case?
Yeah, I mean, the connection actually in a roundabout way came through doing the Nexium podcast. NBC had started this podcast studio. They were interested in investigating CEDU, and they knew about this connection to Synanon. And because I had been working in the cult space, they had reached out to me to host it. And it is, you know, it turns out that, you know, not just that connection to Synanon, but the way that CEDU operated itself had so many similarities to the way that high-pressure organizations, high-control groups, cults actually operate. So it turned out that the research I had done on Nexium and the kind of the deep dive I had done into the cult world was very useful in investigating this program as well.
So it's interesting because in listening to your podcast of The Lost Kids, it was widely known even by the staff members that it was based on the Synanon cult, but none of us knew about it. Our parents didn't know about it. A lot of the parents that dropped off kids there literally had no idea that there was such a connection. And there were, you know, things that literally went from the teachings of Synanon directly into the teachings and the curriculum of CEDU. Will you explain to people who don't know what the teachings of Synanon was and then how that went into CEDU?
Yeah, I mean, and it's really interesting that you're pointing that out because there's two different versions of what CEDU is. There is the version that was advertised to parents to get their kids to say, it wouldn't be a good calling card to say, you know, come send your kids to a cult Synanon spinoff. So there was a version that was advertised in the brochures and the websites and in the meetings. And then there was a version of actually what was going on. So Synanon was it was an organization that started, a group that started in the 50s by Charles E. Diedrich as an alternative to Alcoholics Anonymous. At the time, they weren't accepting drug addicts into Alcoholics Anonymous. And he felt like, and he was a recovered alcoholic himself, and he says that, you know, he noticed this rise in addiction, you know, attached to perhaps the 60s counterculture movement, but just noticed that a lot of youth he felt were off course, and certainly a lot of adults were suffering from addiction, and created this program. But really, you know, he has no credentials in terms of, you know, a therapeutic background or a social work background or a psychology background, but came up with this idea of using an aggressive form of attack therapy as like that was like the therapeutic core of Synanon. For an hour and sometimes hours and sometimes days, people would be put into this very high pressured environment where you'd sit in a circle with your with the other participants in the program. One person would be in the hot seat and they would be attacked. They'd be screamed at, yelled at. I mean, there was only two rules, which was that you couldn't threaten violence or be violent. Other than that, it was no holds barred. You could do, you could say whatever you want. And this idea of using the idea that, you know, his logic was you use this tactic to show the person something truthful about themselves, that if after an hour of being screamed at and yelled at and about your flaws, that somehow, I suppose you would see something about yourself and
see
do something
light,
about it,
so to speak.
That's right. And so that, you know, the Synanon House, when it started, was kind of like this fashionable play. It was in L.A. It had like lots of connections to Hollywood. A lot of celebrities would come through it. It kind of was part of this whole human potential and counterculture movement that was happening. And people really raved about it and found that it was like, that, you know, there were all kinds of anecdotal success stories for folks, but the organization started to shift. And one of the, you know, one of the key changes was when Charles Diederich said, you know, this is a 2-year program, and after 2 years you'll be rehabilitated. And then he shifted to say rehabilitation is a lifelong process, and therefore you can never leave Synanon. You have to be a part of it forever. And then a whole bunch of, you know, they became quite violent and started behaving in. They were called one of America's most dangerous cults. But what happened was is that people from that organization and affiliated with that organization started to scatter and create a Synanon-like program for so-called troubled youth. They borrowed the vernacular. They borrowed this therapeutic model of attack therapy, of a kind of shame-based attack approach to helping people, and they applied it to young people. And, you know, and it was the seeds and eventually would become this billion-dollar industry, what we call this the troubled teen industry. And the connection to CDU is really profound because CDU becomes this foundational moment where you see that philosophy jump over from Synanon, and it becomes, in a lot of ways, the model that dozens of other schools, maybe even hundreds of other programs, use after CDU creates it under Mel Wasserman, its founder.
Right. So you bring up Mel Wasserman. When I went there, I went in, I guess, the end of 1989. And so I was there somewhat at the beginning. I mean, it had been around for a decade at least, right? But Mel was a figure like our God, kind of. We heard about him, you know, in the rafters, and we would always wonder if he was going to show up. And our headmaster at the time was Bill Lane, who I think you spoke to. And Rudy Benz was my, you know, family head, who you also spoke to. So listening to your podcast, I had to really stop and hold in a lot of emotion because the voices I heard were voices that affected my childhood and my teen years for many years. But what you say and bring up is really interesting. None of these people had credentials. So Mel Wasserman was a furniture salesman, right? I mean, this
That's right.
A guy who started my school that we thought was this amazing school at the time and had been told, we are doing things that kids your age never get the chance to. And the price your parents are paying to send you here is like the price of what people are paying to go to the highest end college ever. And you don't know how much your parents care about you. But when we were there, we did not feel like that. Some of the kids that would arrive there would be kidnapped in the middle of the night and brought in at all hours of the morning and not know why they were there. For me, my situation was very similar to many people's situations where we thought we were visiting. I just thought I was there on a tour. And by the time I was up in the dorms being shown what the dorms looked like, my mom had left. And I had to spend, you know, the next almost 3 years there and had no way out. And it was terrifying for a young girl who had never done drugs, had never had sex, never really did anything awful. You know, the most kind of awful thing I had done was be very combative with a single mother and, you know, who didn't know how to deal with me. And but you did see a lot of kids coming in from the California, you know, they were having issues and the courts would send them there, right?
Right.
So I think they did get funneled in through that way. And it would be very interesting to see how their reaction would be versus someone who was like, why am I here? I really don't get what I did that was so awful. But the staff had no, to get back to what I was saying, the staff had no credentials, not only
right.
Mel Wasserman, but the staff who was around us on any given day, right? Is that what you found in your investigation?
No, totally. I mean, there were staff members that seemed to literally been plucked off the street. I mean, they, you know, people were coming with zero background in therapy or often working with kids at all. There was, as you know, many people came through the program, ended up being staff. So their training was just being participants in the program, and their only exposure to what therapy would look like was the form of attack therapy that you guys were doing. So it is, I mean, I was shocked by that. And you know, in the podcast, we do talk to Rudy Benz. I was surprised that he was going to speak, but I also was surprised, you know, there was a sense that he questioned the value of the program on some level, or he was open to some of the criticism, but fundamentally still seemed to stand by this idea that, like, what I saw was people change. What I saw was that if I could modify and control the behaviors of troubled kids by using this. So I don't know, maybe like for 10% of the kids that went there, it was traumatic, but like for 80% of them, it was profoundly. And people come to me today to say there was a difference. So that's what I was going to ask you.
What was the reaction from people that heard your podcast from former students? They must have reached out. How many said it was good versus bad?
You know, there was a point that so tons of people reached out after the podcast came out. And also I spoke to dozens of former residents in the process of putting together the podcast. It was very difficult to find folks who still supported it. It's there. I'm sure you've seen people on social media and Facebook, and people did pop out. And we do include, I think in like the sixth episode, we did include a clip of someone who said, it might not have been for everyone, but it was, you know, it was transformative for me. But my experience was that was the exception. I think a lot of people seem to have an experience that you had, which was, I didn't talk about it. It was deeply traumatic. I had no way of even, I mean, part of, you know, Daniel Ewan's time and certainly your time was this before social media. It was so difficult to form a community and to try and process what happened. And you're in your teens, you're already trying to understand how the world functions and who you are and kind of putting together what the world looks like. And to suddenly be dropped into this surreal, high pressure environment, I think for a lot of people was incredibly traumatizing. And so for a lot of people I talked to, they were like, I haven't talked I hadn't talked about this in decades. I didn't know how to even there was no language I could use to describe what was happening. And I think that has shifted for a bunch of reasons, including social media, but trauma, I think, was a primary response I heard from people that went to the program.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you say that because I pushed it down so much and didn't want to think about it. But then when I did think about it, it was very traumatic. There's so much that has to do with shame and humiliation from that school. Let me just start with explaining to people what it was like. So first of all, there's a certain like vernacular when you go there. There are certain words that you follow. And when I hear these words, you know, your mind changes, or certain music, you know, if certain songs come on, sometimes I have a physical response and I don't even know why. And then it will occur to me, like, I can't listen to John Denver. I can't listen to Kenny Loggins. I can't listen to Crosby, Stills, and Nash, because we were only allowed to listen to certain music when we were there. And it was on repeat in that main house all the time for, you know, the years that you're there. And the songs play over and over in your head, and that's all you can kind of sing. Otherwise, you're out of agreement. The entire school is about being in agreement. And if you're not in agreement, you're punished. And you're literally punished for almost everything. And when you have to, you need to come clean, you need to cop out to the things that you're guilty for. So you're constantly either guilty or you're on, you know, you're doing something good. And if you're guilty and you're copping out, you're on a ban from people. You're not allowed to smile. You're not allowed to touch people. You're constantly on work assignments, or you're on writing assignments. You're alone. You're scrubbing the floor with a toothbrush. You know, you're working on a farm for 6 months. You're chopping wood for 6 months. And that's not even if you're in a bad place. That's what you have to do there. That's what our curriculum was. We didn't go to school for the first year that we were there. Our school was physical school. You know, it was every morning until 12, you have to do something physical, be on the farm or chopping wood. And then in the afternoons, you went to RAPS, which is what you're talking about, which was the game, the where you're being attacked for 3 hours, where you sit in a circle. And they would call off your name Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and you would be in a room with 15 to 20 people, and you would be attacked. And it's almost emotional for me to talk about. I have talked about this in so many years, but they would find something. You could not get out of the room without them finding something to attack you for. And it wasn't just attacking. So, I mean, it could just be the smallest thing. If I was making noise with the spoons in the dining room, they would use that and say, but you only want attention. And it would go into God knows what, and the entire room would get on board and start screaming at you. And the kids would have to get up from one side of the room, change chairs to yell at you. And you couldn't survive unless you had an emotional breakthrough and started crying and screaming and hitting the floor to have this breakthrough. And you had to do this 3 times a week for years. And it was horrible. So they had to break you down. I'm so sorry that I'm crying. But they had to break you down to build you back up. And it was horrifying. And then at the end, you're sort of like, they go around, how was your rap? And I remember everyone's response, oh, it was really hard, but good. It was, you know, I feel good. I feel really, I feel like I'm really making progress. I mean, that's crazy. It's crazy.
It is. I mean, it took me so long to even try to wrap my head around this. And I felt like, you know, making the podcast, it felt like a daunting task of like, how do you even describe this weird alternate universe that people are dropped into? And I think like one of the things about CDU as compared to there's definitely been cases and allegations around sexual abuse and physical abuse at CDU. Other programs employed that even, you know, more as a tactic. But I think one of the challenges with CDU was that the abuse was psychological. And in some ways, that abuse is invisible. And it's like it's hard to always show it and prove it and have, you know, I think for a lot of former residents, they weren't believed. I mean, they come out of this thing and part of the not speaking they told me was that because I couldn't explain it. I didn't have the language to explain it and no one would believe me when it happened. But like what you're describing, those rap sessions, I mean, I can't even imagine, you know, and I've heard this so many times, but what it would mean for 13 or 14 or 15 or anyone really to be sitting there and subjected to that kind of abuse for that long. And so one of the responses I heard from people, I'm curious to know if this was your experience, is there's a certain period of time of resistance where your mind is like, what the hell is going on? This is not normal. This is not okay. And then there's a resignation to it. Like there's a kind of survival for a lot of people. I mean, some folks run away and you know, that we'll probably get to it in terms of what Daniel Ewan did after just 10 days was run away, which was what many kids do. It was a natural response to what happened. But then there's kind of like I have to survive this and resign to this environment. And there's so few cracks, it sounded like, so few ways to be resistant. I mean, resistance was met with punishment. So it's sort of like put your head down and get through it. I mean, is that what you found?
Oh, absolutely. You could not resist anything. I mean, you even just from, again, being out of agreement, just peeing in the shower wasn't allowed and you would get punished. I mean, it was right. To this day, I will not spit my gum on the ground because in the back of my head, I'm like, I will get punished for that. So I am so careful on things that I do. But I want to go back to one thing you said. There was nothing tangible that happened to me there. You know, I didn't get physically abused. I was not sexually abused. So when people talk about CDU and if you got abused there, and I hear people that talk about this abuse that went on there, none of that happened there to me. None of that happened in the almost 3 years that I was there. I don't think to anyone that was at that school because it was run in a way that we would have seen it. No one's ever complained about it there at that time, but we were so abused emotionally. And and when you don't have something tangible like that, it's exactly what you said. It's you can't explain it to anyone. You have no proof. And to this day, I try and bring it up with my mother. And, you know, she will not listen. She just says, you loved it there. What are you talking about? You did so well there. You had the best time. You had so many friends. And it just triggers me back to that place where I was 14 years old and I just feel like no one's listening to me and I'm just stuck in this position where I'm just like, okay, forget it. And you had someone on your podcast that went by Medium, I think, who said he wrote an entire piece and for the purpose that people could use that link to send to their parents and let it right. speak for themselves. And I had to stop the podcast when I was listening and be like, oh my God, because I did that. I read that piece on Sidhu and I forwarded that exact piece to my mother. And still to this day, she won't apologize. She won't even, not even apologize. She won't just acknowledge what happened to me. And that breaks my heart. You know, it's really tough on me for that. But to get back to what you were asking, yes, for it took me a while to get the courage up to run away. I ran away three times while I was there. The first time I didn't get very far. The second time I was sent to juvenile hall because my mother wouldn't take me home. She thought it was a great program. And you know, what I forgot to say before is our calls and our mail was monitored. So you couldn't write out and be like, this is miserable. I'm miserable. Come get me, because they would not let you send that letter. And on our calls, we would have a call once every 2 weeks or so, 10 days, and it was for 15 minutes. But somebody would be in the room listening to you. So if you said anything remotely negative, the call would be ended and they literally would terminate the call. And so you started to learn not to say anything awful about wanting to leave because you didn't want that time to be terminated because you didn't get it back. You know, you just you were aching to speak to somebody and you no longer could speak to your friends from home. You had no access to the outside world. So you come to realize I'm not going to ask to go home anymore because they don't believe me. And apparently I found out later the parents are given a handbook and, you know, are told, listen, the kids are going to say this, this, and this. So don't respond.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
I absolutely love that first firing up of the grill on a warm summer evening. Do you or someone else in your home take grilling as seriously as I do? The Burger Perfection Pack is an incredible deal for just $99.99. This exclusive package includes 20 of Omaha Steaks' mouth-watering steak burgers. That's four of each of their finest burgers. Pure ground filet mignon, New York strip, ribeye, brisket, and sirloin. Only available at omahasteaks.com. Impress your next dinner party or family cookout with exclusive products not available at grocery stores. All backed by Omaha Steaks' 100% money-back guarantee. Get ready for grilling season with the mouth-watering Omaha Steaks Burger Perfection Pack. Plus 8 free Wagyu Smash Burgers for just $99.99. Go to omahasteaks.com and as a bonus, use promo code YUM to get $35 off your order. That's $35 off with promo code YUM. Terms apply. See site for details.
Here's your response. Well, no, it's so interesting because that, you know, looking at this program through a cult lens, the experts I talked to said it was the parents who were groomed for the cult, not the kids. The kids were sent there unwillingly. I mean, unlike another cult where you have to entice people and love bomb them and bring them in all kinds of ways, there you have custody. So it's not an issue. You can't, you know, you could try and run away or whatever, but it's the parents that you have to convince. And one of the strategies is this different version of CDU that is presented to them. And, you know, that and that close monitoring of information, not allowing the residents of the program to say anything to their parents, giving the parents a handbook. I mean, like, that is such a Daniel Ewan's parents, Wayne and Lisa, talk about this and how duped they felt because Daniel complained to them. He was in there for a few days. This is a terrible school. And Wayne said, yeah, I had the handbook. I knew that Daniel was going to say this. And I was instructed to say, OK, it's going to be fine. Stick it out. And, you know, there's a huge amount of regret and guilt and pain, I think, associated with that con, that dupe that he felt the program pulled the wool over his eyes and didn't. It gave someone like Daniel, and it sounds like it gave you, sort of no option to complain because, you know, you can't turn to any adults in your life.
Right. So then you start to feel like you want to take matters into your own hands and you're like, I have to leave. I have no other option. And there were no gates, so you could leave.
Right.
And it was really only the other students who kind of would talk you down from doing this. And they would be like, well, if you leave, you're going to hurt us and you're going to hurt yourself and, you know, all this bullshit, really. So on the third time when I attempted to leave, my parents were divorced at the time. My father lived in Alaska and he had sent me, he didn't believe in the program and didn't like it and didn't like my mother and had sent me $1,000 in a Rick Astley CD. So it was considered contraband. And I opened the Rick Astley CD and I knew I was going to have to give it back because we can't listen to music. And
right.
I somehow saw that it was packed with something and I found the money. So I took the money out. I handed in the CD saying, oh, look, I'm copping out. I got this CD. I'm not allowed to have it. And I stuffed the money in my pocket and I immediately was like, I'm out of here. I didn't realize like I was going to run away again. But with that money, I knew, OK, I'm out of here. So I ran away a third time and I was going to go. The money was to get a plane ticket and to go see my father. So I get to the I hitchhiked down to the bottom of the mountain. This is a very dangerous place. I mean, going down to the bottom of the mountain, hitchhiking as a single female was like not a very smart idea. But somehow I made it down, hitchhiked, got down to the bottom. I called my brother, who my half-brother, who I had from my father's side, who I had not seen since I was 4 years old. He happened to live in LA. He picked me up and he was supposed to take me to the airport. And he said, this seems a little odd. I want to see the school. And if I don't like the school, I'll take you to dad. But our father had some drug issues, so he didn't want me necessarily to go to my father's house. So he takes me back up to the school after staying with him for a couple of days and getting to know him. And he goes and he sits in a room with Rudy Benz and Bill Lane and these people. And I sat up in the couches. And 4 hours later, he comes back and he sits with me. And he's like, Rachel, this is an amazing school. And you have to stay. I'm not going to take you back with me. And I was just like, oh, fuck, I'm stuck here again. And so to answer your question, that's exactly, you know, at that point, I was like, okay, I'm done. This was my last attempt. I'm never getting out of here. And something in me clicked. And I was just like, I have no support. I have no way out. So I started thinking, all right, I only have at that point, I think I had like a year and a half left. So I was like, okay, I'm going to just try and get through this because I'm never getting out of here.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so, and it sounds like you graduated. I mean, you made it all the way through.
I did. But I will say shortly after that, I had a phone call with my father who, again, on these phone calls, they're listened to. And my father has had a drug addiction. And now that I had become the student that was following the rules, you draw a lot of boundaries, right? And my father was high. And the person that answered his phone actually was Hector Macho Camacho. He was staying at his house. I don't know if you remember him. But so my first 9 minutes of the call was with Macho Camacho saying, oh, we're busy. We can't talk. Da, da, da. Your father's busy. I finally get my father on the phone and he's completely you know, blasted on cocaine and high and whatever. And we get into this argument and a little bit, and I say, the woman's looking at me, or it wasn't a woman, it was another student, as a matter of fact, and she's sitting right there. And I know that I have to draw this boundary because I felt like I'm here at this program. I want to do it now, right? And I said, Dad, now that you're doing drugs, you've chosen drugs over me, I can't have this relationship anymore. And he said, you're reminding me of your mother. You're such a fucking bitch. I've never loved you. So he goes on this whole rant, really getting angry with me. And he's like, fuck off, you know, and keeps repeating, I never loved you. So I hung up on him. And about 6 days later, my headmaster had to end up telling me that my father had died of a cocaine overdose. So that was a whole horrible experience I had also at CDU. Yeah, because I then realized I was really on my own, because he kind of was my last way out. And then I never went home after that. Like, after I left, I went on to another school and went to to college. And so, you know, I realized that my life was like literally about being on my own after that. So I wanted to ask you more about Daniel. Daniel left after a week, right, of being there 10 days?
That's right. He was there for 10 days, you know, a similar experience to you in terms of he got taken to the school by his parents on what he thought was a tour and to kind of check it out. And or he had gone, but sort of, you know, I think his parents said, if you don't like it, we can leave. And he didn't like it. He got totally the bad vibes from the place from the get-go, didn't want to go. And they said to him, you know what? They said to the parents, let's just take him to the headmaster. He'll talk to him. And it'll be a fine. And then half an hour later, they came back to his parents and said, Daniel's fine. He wants to stay. You guys can go. And they left. There's, you know, little evidence that Daniel changed his mind because he 10 days later decided to do what, you know, we found out hundreds of kids like you did, which was leave, as opposed to run away. And as you mentioned, there's no gate, but CDU is very isolated. It's up on top of the San Bernardino Mountains. There's kind of two ways out. You either go down the one road that leads to the school, and the community is very aware of the program that's there, and they will call the cops, and people get picked up really frequently. Or your other option is to go down what you called the backside, which was this, you know, basically the side of a mountain with nothing there. It's kind of this very barren desert landscape. You can see San Bernardino way in the distance. You might even feel like it's closer than it is, but it's not an easy thing to get to. And, you know, there's not a lot of water. There's a lot of wildlife. One theory is that Daniel did try to go down that route and didn't make it. But we don't know. His body was never discovered. When the program called Daniel Yuen's parents and said that he's gone, they suggested that they had a service, a private investigator that would look for the kids. And they sort of outsourced the issue right away to this guy, Keith Raymond, who, you know, was supposed to be an expert in finding kids. And the UN had to fork out a whole bunch more money to hire this guy to look for their son. And in my research or in my investigation, I don't think this investigator was credible at all. I mean, I sort of went and followed his footsteps, and he made claims of credible sightings of Daniel Yuen in San Bernardino. He even claimed that he himself got a phone call from Daniel Yuen saying, stop looking for me. When you kind of scratch beneath the surface, none of it really checks out. And it's a case, again, it's sort of like the double victimization of the Yuen family. They first were taken advantage because they didn't know what to do for their son, who was struggling, you know, with mental health issues, not crazy mental health issues. I mean, not abnormal, outlier issues. It was kind of teenage depression, but they didn't know what to do. And that's where CDU swooped in, promising that they could fix their son. And then again, you know, they're in this moment of vulnerability. Their son is gone. And suddenly this fairly sketchy private investigator shows up and charges them a bunch of money to look for their son. So it did, you know, their story was tragic on a lot of levels, but spoke to how this industry can prey on parents who are not sure how to help their kids.
Yeah, 100%. Now, in your documentary, your podcast, you had mentioned about that phone call that Keith suggests he gets or alleges he gets. And I wondered, had he ever, had the parents asked to listen to the phone call, to the audio tape?
The parents had, you know, he had a very strange story about it. And he was sort of promising to play it for them. And then he promised to send it to me. You know what? Actually, initially, the story's changed. Initially, the story was that somebody else called and said, stop looking for Daniel, I'm his friend. That's what he had told the parents. When I talked to him on the phone, he said, no, Daniel called me. And by the way, he had this, like, I know it was Daniel because he had this kind of vague Asian accent. Now, Daniel Ewan was born and raised in New Jersey. I mean, I shared this with his friend, Nick Galeta, who was his best friend growing up, and Nick just laughed. He's like, the kid had a New Jersey accent. Like, why would he have, his heritage, his lineage, his background comes from China, but that's not what his accent was. So clearly it was bullshit.
But what I didn't understand is why the parents, if they're hearing that from Keith, why they didn't demand, I want to hear this voicemail. I need to hear it and go to the police. And, you know, instead it seemed like they were just very happy with him and they believed him. And that made me really sad for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And my sense is that I agree. And I'm sort of even a little bit torn about what to say about Keith, because the Ewans do believe that their son is alive, or at least they did at the time, and they had a lot of faith in Keith, at least at the time I was making the podcast. I think that's shifted a bit, and he was quite manipulative. So yes, they wanted once they knew about the recording, they wanted the recording, but then suddenly he had to run away from the police because he had been investigating the story too deeply and he was ruffling feathers, and then he was on his deathbed and was too sick to respond to anything. So he had a million stories, and the stories were like, he wasn't even a good liar. I mean, in my correspondence with him, I kept pressing him to say, send me the tape, send me whatever, and then he said, I can't. He had a bunch of different stories. Then he said, I have 48 hours to live. I'm on my deathbed. I'm sorry. This is my last dance. And then I got an email the next day from his email account saying, hey, Josh, this is Steve. I'm Keith's brother. And I see you've been corresponding with him, but I'm sorry. He's now incapacitated and he's too ill to correspond with you.
So is he dead?
Which was just like...
Well, it turns out a few months later, you Googled Keith Raymond and like his website popped up again, and he has a contact information there, and it seems he is alive and well and did not die.
Oh, my goodness.
I think he's a strange and not a particularly good liar. And I think, at the end of the day, I think the Ewans did start to realize that not everything he was saying was truthful.
Which is so horrible for them. I mean, I just feel for them so much because, of course, they want to have hope. And there is an answer to what happened, right? I mean, nobody just disappears into thin air. But what happened with the police? I mean, why were they not more involved?
Well, a huge pattern I discovered in this investigation is the failure of authorities to do anything about this program. So, yes, you were talking before about that primarily there was psychological abuse, but there was a lot of violations of CDU's license as a program working with kids. And when we asked, we did a Freedom of Information with the California Department of Social Services, and we saw that there were hundreds of complaints made to them and they were not followed up on, including the type A complaints, which are the most egregious. So, talking about withholding food from kids, physical abuse. There were also allegations. One former resident said that she was repeatedly raped by two other residents and had complained to the teachers in the program, and nothing was done. And so what we saw, and we pressed the Department of Social Services on this, and why did no one do anything? And we really got the runaround on it. And a lot of it is just sort of shirking responsibility. It was previous folks running the department, or we have limited information. And it was the same thing with the San Bernardino police. I was not able to get very far in an accountability. I mean, for example, if you're getting hundreds of phone calls complaining about kids running away from this program, are you not investigating that and potentially shutting it down? Like, it's a waste of police resources, and it certainly is a indication that it's not a safe space for kids. So we couldn't, there was a former police, there had been efforts over the years for people to try and investigate this and get accountability, but it hasn't gone anywhere. And you mentioned before someone named Medium, who was a former resident, who had written a blog post on CDU. He's actually since come out behind his he no longer is using that pseudonym. It's David Safran. He's he has been really doggedly researching this for years. He recently wrote a piece for the Los Angeles Times, and he came on board as a producer on our project. But he has been doing the legwork to try and, you know, file, to just get more information, to hold people accountable. He had another private investigator that had stepped into, a prominent detective that had stepped into the San Bernardino department and taken up this case, you know, looking at past abuses, looking at not just Daniel Ewan, but there's two other missing boys from the program. And she was promptly shut down. I mean, she was just like, that was whisked away from her. It appears to me like the behavior of the police is that they're hiding something, that they know more, and they don't want somebody to dig into this too far.
Right. Well, also, I just remember from when we were there, I mean, the credibility factor of the kids was at zero, right? I mean, the police thought that we were a bunch of crazies living at CDU, and nothing we said should be trusted, because I do remember running away. And I think once I ran away with another girl, maybe the first time that we didn't get too far, we got into the town, which is just past the road. And there's a bar there and maybe a phone booth or something and a candy shop maybe. And I remember the cop finding us, and we were trying to talk to him like, oh my God, okay, at least thank God somebody we can talk to. And he just was like, no, okay, you know, and just did not believe a word we said. And we kept trying to explain, you know, oh my God, you don't understand. I had to dig a grave with a spoon and lay in it. Like, you don't understand. This is crazy what they're doing to us up there. And the guy's like, get in the car, girls, come on. And just took us back. And we were like, oh my God, no one understands what it's like there. And I felt like the people in the town just saw us as like these really over the top troubled kids and really didn't know what was going on there. Plus, the people that worked at that school also had a lot of, you know, their fingers were deep in that community. I mean, Dennis Dockstetter worked there, and he also owned the camp right there. I mean, when I later on in my, you know, years at the school, I ended up getting like an internship at his camp and, you know, spending time outside of CDU and working for him. I thought he was the greatest, you know, so I became really brainwashed, thinking this was like, you know, where I wanted to be and who I wanted to be around. And by the way, at the end of my stay, I was the one running the dinner dishes committee, which was when you got in trouble, you would be on dinner dishes. You had to clean up the whole kitchen and do, you know, slop the pigs and do all this crazy stuff. Right. I was in charge. So I had to decide what kid was going on what work assignment. And I, you know, if they were scrubbing this or scrubbing that, and I had to be the one to check them off. And I would have to go around and talk to each one about what they did wrong and how they feel now and if they feel regretful, and then let them go back to their normal activities. So it was really monitored by the kids. And I was so, like, thinking back at this now, I was so fucked up by being the person that wanted to leave at the beginning and then at the end being part of the problem. I mean, I was pushing them down, right? And I remember having those conversations with them being like, it's going to get better. It's going to get easier. I was just like you at the beginning. And, you know, the roles just turned, but that's how CDU was. You started out being really rebellious and you ended up being this disciple of CDU. And that's kind of how they got you to graduation, you know, being the person running out of these rooms with your hands in the air, going through these profits, being like, I'm number one. And like, I don't even know what that means. Like, it was just nuts. I mean, I hear the theme from Rocky, and I think of coming through the doors from the I Want to Live profit after we've spent two nights totally not being able to sleep and having kids hold you down and try to get up and music blasting in your ear. And you come out of this workshop and you've just been totally, you know, brainwashed for 48 hours and humiliated and shamed and pushed to the end degree of like abuse. And then you come out feeling so good. I don't even know how that happens to anyone.
Right. Right. But I mean, it is, people have, reviewing that curriculum, they're like, oh, this is the same. I mean, you use the term brainwashing. When the experts look at it, they're like, it is the same kind of techniques that are used in CIA interrogations, like minus maybe the waterboarding. But when we talk about sleep deprivation, food deprivation, the use of music, like all those elements that people use to brainwash or to, you know, to torture people, that was the tools and tactics of CDU. And, you know, you mentioned profits, just, probably just to explain. Also, I couldn't, it took me a long time to wrap my head around this, but, you know, you talked about the rap sessions, which happened weekly, but these profits, which if I remember correctly, are like 48 hours, 72 hours, sometimes you're not really even sleeping at all, that you run through this very intensive form of kind of like, kind of hippie, kind of CIA torture, kind of like human potential stuff. Until, you know, in Nexium, they talked a lot about these like engineered epiphanies, and it feels like that's what they were trying to do there as well, where they push people to this point of like, there's all this pressure to have a breakthrough and to experience this kind of breakthrough, and that like part of making your way out of CDU, from what I heard from people that went through this, was to go to these profits that were scattered throughout the time that you were there and show and prove that you were having this transformational experiences from these really bizarre sets of exercises that are forced on the kids that are there. That part, again, wild, surreal. I constantly, and me and the producers talked a lot about like, how do we transport people into this world? It is so strange. It is so bizarre.
Again, I hadn't thought about it for years, but I think there was 7 prophets. By the way, they're based on Cahil Gibran's book, The Prophet. And, there was, first of all, when you found out when you were going into your next prophet, it was like you were so excited. You now got to the next level and you were like moving up on the chain, and that's how you established who you were within the program. Oh yeah, I've been through my I Want to Live, and people would look at you and be like, oh my God, I can't wait to be her. Wow, she's so like, you know, she's at that level that she's done that. I mean, that kind of reminds me about what I hear about Scientology, like when you hear about people have hit certain levels. And again, I never thought about this before, but it was really like that. So the first one was like, the truth shall set you free. And then it was the children's prophet. And then it was, the I Want to Live and the values and the all these ones, where each one for 24 hours or 48 hours, you do not sleep. And you go in, and it's basically workshops, but they're physical workshops where you're doing really crazy things. That are stressing you out. There's a lot of crying. There's a lot of screaming. It's almost like a rap, but no one's really yelling at you. But you're doing a lot of intense work with the group, with your peer group that you go through the entire experience with, which is a group of like 18 people that started the school with you around the same 2 months. You all got there at the same time, and I can't even explain. I mean, one of the things I do remember, I think it was in the I Want to Live, I sort of mentioned it before, but you had to be on all fours, and then maybe a couple of the kids were instructed to put their hands on top of you. And then they said, we're going to turn on the music. And as soon as we turn on the music, do what we say. So there was an instructor, a staff member in my ear, and then an instructor standing with the people that were above me. And as soon as the music went on, I didn't really know what was going to happen. It was super loud. And the staff member yells at me, get up, do everything you can to get up. Oh my God, I'm sorry. And
it's
so horrible. And so it's just like, you're like, oh my God, okay. So I'm on all fours and I try and get up. And obviously I can't because the kids have their hands on me and they're pushing me down. And so when the music started, the instructor yelled to those kids, push her down. Don't let her get up. So they're doing everything they can to push me down. I'm doing everything I can to get up. And then the other kids who weren't picked to do it are just watching from their seats. They're crying because they're watching this happen. And it's so emotional because we're all so close, right? We're all really good friends. And the staff is yelling at the kids pushing me down. Who have you pushed down in your life? What have you done to people to push them down? And the staff yelling at me is saying, who's kept you down in your life, and who's been responsible for never letting you get up? Is it you? Is it your father? Is it your mother? What is it? And they're screaming at you, and it's so emotional and terrifying. And You don't know when it's going to end, and it's physically exhausting. Anyways, that was just one example of something I remember from a prof eat. So they were awful.
Yeah, yeah. Bizarre.
And bizarre. And then you're supposed to come out of them feeling like you had this big epiphany of, you know, and you come out with words like, I am forgiving. I now know that I'm honest, or I now know that I'm XYZ for everyone that was involved. So I will say, you know, with my experience at CDU, I know I'm a much more in touch person than most of the people I know. I am so deeply connected with myself. I've never lived at home since that day. I've raised myself, basically. I find that when I meet people, I am very in tune with people and their energy and who they are. I learned that from being at CDU, but I live in a much more heightened state of awareness or threat or shame or humiliation than probably most people, because I'm so used to the confrontation and the and always feeling like something's going to happen. So the way I react towards people is also very different. I might yell when I talk and not even realize that I'm being confrontational, and then be like, okay, I want to get some pizza. And people are like devastated. They're like, you were just screaming at me about something. And I'm like, no, I wasn't. I was just telling you how I feel, but now that's over. So like, let's go cuddle or whatever, you know? and it does not go over well. And so that kind of thing has never left me. But I feel like I'm good about following agreements and rules and boundaries, so to speak, because of that school.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Reflection is like, one, I heard both from former residents of these programs, but also from people that left NXIVM about the process of leaving and how there's a stage of like total rejection of everything. Like everything about NXIVM was bad, everything I learned was bad, or everything about CDU was bad, everything I learned was bad, all the people are bad. And then some people say, well, there's something more complicated going on. And I think even, you know, the experts, the ex-cult experts do talk about like there's a complexity there that you can learn things. Some of those relationships can be real. Like, you know, it is not just what is those worlds are not just what was created by the people running it, but it's also a community of people that participated. So some of those relationships are authentic. Some of the things you learn and the growth that happens can be real. And I imagine it sounds like very difficult to parse out what of this is toxic and what of it's what's valuable. You know, especially inside these programs that purport to be to help people be better, and being in it so long, just like there's wherever you would have been, or wherever someone who lives from the age of 14 to 16, it's a really profound age, you know, to develop and grow, and so not all that gets to be attributed to CDU. You know, some of it is just what happens naturally in the development process in those moments. And I imagine that that can just be a really exhausting task to be like, is this bad or is this good? Was this valuable or invaluable? And how do I figure out like which pieces to hang on to?
And what I did learn from that program too is I do have some friends who are parents. I mean, I have a 10-year-old daughter, and they're talking to me about how, you know, their kids who are a little bit older now, maybe anywhere from 13 to 18, are giving them problems, and they're thinking of sending them to wilderness schools or some sort of therapeutic school. And I feel like I'm really knowledgeable on the subject. So I stop them and I say, listen, what I learned from my experience in having that happened to me is that your kids just want to be heard. And sometimes the acting out is about not feeling like they know that their place within your relationship with them. So I think that, you know, my advice for those parents that are having a difficult time with kids, and I'm not talking about kids that are doing illegal things, I'm talking about kids that are struggling with communicating with you, or you're struggling communicating with them, and you don't know what else to do. Sometimes kids want to hear I love you. They want to hear that you're needed, that you're important to them, that with, you know, and I know that kind of feels gross sometimes to like a 13-year-old girl and her mom or whatever, but like sometimes they do not feel important. And so they look for love in other places, and they get in trouble and they just feel lost, and they're having a hard time in school and their parents don't understand that. So instead of listening, they punish them. And I think that that becomes the problem, and the kids just feel so lonely and misunderstood. And so that's what I saw from the entire entire gamut of the kid that was brought in from Watts, you know, and got in so much trouble to the kid that was just truant and having some major problems. You know, they just didn't feel loved. And so I would mention that to any parents that right before they think about doing the alternative. So anyways, my question for you was, what did you find that finally was the reason that CDU closed? Do you know?
I think there was a bunch of different reasons, including, in no small part, there was mounting court cases against them. So CDU Running Springs was just one of, I think, 7 programs that they were running. Rocky Mountain Academy in Idaho was another one where there were a number of lawsuits. So they were being dragged through the courts. Some of those were successful. They had to make some big payouts.
So parents were catching on to the fact that this was not a good place.
Exactly. I mean, it's not good press, not good publicity for them. And so it kind of, you know, they had an opportunity to get bought out and they sold. I don't know, you know, all the ins and outs of what led to the financial collapse, but it clearly wasn't helping them that they had all these court cases pending, including, by the way, the UN sued them as well. And they eventually sold, and then the company they sold to went into bankruptcy. And now I think there's one program that still sort of exists, not run by CDU, but sort of as the last remaining program for troubled youth that comes from that. That's CDU Corporation, but there are hundreds that exist of other programs in the troubled teen industry, and they exist in different format. So this is one, this therapeutic boarding school is kind of like one version of the programs for troubled teens. But there's, as you mentioned, the wilderness programs, which is like the same thing, but in the wilderness and even cheaper to run because you don't have to like pay for a facility. There's the military boot camps. And then there's this kind of other scary, you know, cluster of programs that are religious based, and they get it's much harder to regulate because of religious exemptions. And you kind of don't get the same oversight or scrutiny. The limited oversight that there is on any of these programs doesn't even apply in a lot of cases to the religiously based programs.
So now that you've done all this investigation, would you ever send your kids to one of these types of schools?
Hard no. no, and look, I do – that's not to say that I couldn't imagine a situation where I would need support for a kid that's struggling. And we know that like mental health is a huge epidemic and was amplified by the pandemic. And there's a big gap, especially I'm based in Canada. We have a little bit more of a safety net, but in terms of resources for youth, and we have a mental health crisis here for young people as well. But the thing that I would look for is credentialed people and organizations that have people with master's degree and higher to work with kids. And one of the things that experts say is the best kind of help a teenager or a kid can get is one that keeps them in the community, keeps them in their home, allows them to thrive in the environment that they're in and not to remove them. There are cases where someone does need to get removed, and there are programs that are good and legitimate where that can happen, but that should really be the last resort. What you know, the most helpful thing is to find people that that are experienced and trained in this, and obviously, like, the thing is that CDU was billing itself as a solve for ADHD and Asperger's and depression and truancy. Like, it was sort of everything, a one-stop shop for everything. Like, that also doesn't exist. I think you have to be very targeted in giving kids the kind of resources they need to address the particular issue that they're facing. So that promise, which can be, I'm sure, is very attractive, and I'm also a parent, and I can imagine the kind of stress that comes along with seeing a kid struggle with a mental health issue or with anything with growing up. And so I do definitely empathize with parents that made that choice. But I do think, you know, now more than ever, we have so many resources at our fingertips to do the research that and recognize that obviously resources are limited, but in terms of financial resources to get kids programs. But I do think turning to people that actually have a legit background in this is helpful, rather than a program that is a quick fix for all your problems.
Yeah, that's actually very important advice. So what is the latest with the Daniel Yuen story? I read that there were sightings of him in San Diego and people were saying that he may be alive. But is that just because of the ridiculous comments from Keith?
Yeah, I mean, there's been no significant update on his case. I mean, it's still unresolved. The only cases where someone has come, you know, and claimed to have seen him have been related to Keith. And, you know, the UNs went out there a bunch of times. The last, you know, there was an initial round of searching for him closer, you know, for the few years after his disappearance. Then Keith reemerged back in 2017, I believe, saying that he wanted to reinvestigate. And at that time, kind of dug up some more sightings. But it's only really related to him. There's no other advancement. And it's not, again, it's both Daniel Yuen, but there was also two other boys that a few years before Daniel Yuen disappeared, also disappeared from the program. And no one knows what's happened. Those are open cases.
And what do you know the details a little bit with those? Didn't they have something to do with wasn't there a child molester in the area?
Yeah, there was, you know, no one has proven the direct connection between the two, but it did come out that James Crummell, who was eventually arrested and charged with pedophilia and child molestation, had spent time at the school and was at the school and had contact with the kids there, and he sort of was traveling around. Sorry?
As a staff member or?
Not as a staff member. He was visiting. He was on this kind of strange, he lived with his therapist, and him and his therapist were traveling around to different programs that worked with youth. So he somehow had access for a few weeks. Like, I don't think he was on staff, but they'd obviously paid him or allowed him to come into the service. So he had contact. He was there around the time that those boys went missing, and there were other cases of kids going missing at that time that were related to him. So one of the questions is whether he was responsible. He's no longer alive, so it's hard to get it directly from him.
He died in jail.
He died in jail. Yeah.
And were those kids, they had run away and gone missing, or they just disappeared?
I believe they had, no, those two had run away.
Okay.
And it was, I mean, I spoke with Blake Pursley's mother about her story, and it is just like unbelievably heartbreaking in terms, again, of, you know, Blake Pursley, one of the boys that had gone missing, was in was disabled from an accident as a kid, and they got a bunch of insurance money to give him, like, really, he needed really a lot of support, both mental and physical. And the mom got totally duped by CDU and claimed that they had all these resources to support him. And he obviously was very unhappy in the place and ran away. But they don't know. We don't know. You know, the account is like very limited. You have these reports from CDU that says, you know, we saw him walk off the campus at X time, and then we don't know what happened. So that's CDU's claim, is that they both walked away.
Wow. That's just incredible. Okay, so in doing your research on cults, you also did NXIVM. Talk to me about NXIVM. Explain what NXIVM is to people that don't know.
So NXIVM, it's funny because, you know, when we started investigating it, really no one knew what NXIVM was. I think more people do now because it was in the media for a little while. But NXIVM built itself as a self-help organization that then the FBI kind of shut down and eventually arrested its leadership for, they were charged for racketeering and a whole bunch of other kinds of abuses of the members there. But the critics of the organization say it was a cult, and it really was this organization very tightly wrapped around a charismatic leader named Keith Raniere, who claimed that he had developed a philosophy that could help people achieve their dreams and successes. Sometimes those dreams and successes were achieved by sleeping with Keith Raniere. And sometimes people were forced to do that because they were being blackmailed.
Wow. So the thing that came out of NXIVM that I think surprised people the most is that women were branded. And your friend from childhood was one of the women that was branded. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, that's how I came by this story, was that a woman who I have known since daycare was part of this organization for many years, for I think over 12 years. And she was actually their star recruiter. She lived in Vancouver. She opened up a NXIVM Center in Vancouver. She brought in a lot of folks from the acting and from the yoga community to be a part of NXIVM and take, you know, NXIVM's bread and butter was running these expensive self-help workshops that people would, you know, pay more and more money to kind of ascend through the levels, maybe not unlike, you know, Scientology in that sense, to learn to be a better person. But as you got higher up in the organization, you started to become privy to some of the more cultic and strange activities within the organization. Sarah was invited to become part of this secret women's group that was supposed to take her training to the next level. So she herself had spent tens of thousands of dollars on her own curriculum and self-improvement and just sort of this endless hamster wheel of like pouring in more money to deal with her deep deficiencies. And so when one of her mentors approached her and said, hey, like you're going to achieve, you know, your greatest heights in NXIVM and really take your training to the next level, it's part of this all women's group. And in order to be a part of it, you have to give over collateral. So things that if they came out would destroy your life. And at that point, you know, that concept of collateral had been introduced previously. But at that point inside the organization, it didn't feel strange enough not to do it. And so she gave over nude photos and videos and that, you know, she's supposed to give over the deed to her apartment. And she gave over, like, she had to create videos of her saying awful things about her loved ones, about her husband and about her mother. So these were things that then were given to the people running the secret women's group and would be released if she ever violated the terms of being involved. And it was kind of like a mini pyramid scheme inside NXIVM. So people, you know, she was then the slave of a master who had recruited her, and she was required to recruit other slaves into it. And it became this incredibly controlled group that if your master texted you, you had to text back within, you know, a circumscribed amount of time, within minutes. You know, are you ready? Yes, I'm ready. You had to, there was a whole bunch of things that you had to constantly like achieve your goals. You had to keep re-upping on your collateral to you know, show your commitment to the group. And then she was brought to Albany, or just outside Albany, where NXIVM was headquartered, and told that she was going to be initiated in this final step to get into the women's group. And then discovered, you know, it was a whole kind of ceremony, and she was brought into this room naked. And a doctor, actually, that was part of the group, was sitting there with a cauterizing iron and etched into, like, just, you know, right next to her crotch, this brand. Which she was told at the time was a symbol, later discovered that actually it was the initials KR, Keith Raniere. And when the FBI investigated this, you know, this specific secret women's group inside NXIVM became a huge focus for the FBI investigation. And they discovered, in fact, that he was the one running, you know, the all-women's group. All that collateral was going to him. He was well aware of what was happening. And some of the women that were in that secret women's group were told that they had to sleep with Keith Raniere or their collateral would be released. So it was this crazy blackmail situation. Sarah Edmondson, you know, the woman I knew from daycare, sort of has a wake-up call around that time and decides that she's, whatever the consequences are going to be, go public and leave the organization. And so I ran into her about it.
What do you think that wake-up call was? I'm curious.
I think there was a bunch of converging forces. I think if you zoom out a little bit and look at what was happening with the organization, it was imploding. It was what was happening is that Keith Raniere is a narcissist and he needed control. And if you track what was happening over the course of the decades that it was operation, feeding that narcissism meant having more and more control of the people that were in the organization. And it happened in a way that was unsustainable. So for a long time, I think there were red flags. She could put it aside and just say, oh, look, I don't want to even focus on the weird stuff. I'm just going to focus on this like great curriculum that we're learning and I'm helping people grow. But the more she got into it and the more red flags emerged and the more he had to control people, I think it became clear that this was not something she wanted to be a part of. Certainly the physical trauma of being branded, I think, was a big wake-up call. And then starting to realize actually what was happening and starting to hear rumors that he was actually at the top of this thing. She was getting bits and pieces of information that what she had been sold was not true. And I think it was obviously terrifying for her. I ran into her literally a month after she had left. I mean, Nexium was like up and running still. People had tried to leave before and they were dragged in their lives were destroyed by Nexium. In the same way that Scientology would go after people that defected, Nexium would go after people really aggressively. And so when I ran into her, she was like reeling and barely intelligible. I mean, she was still trying to process what had happened to her, and Nexium, like Sidhu, uses a lot of like jargon, and so she's trying to explain the story to me, and I couldn't actually entirely track it, but I did track. You know, I ran to her a few times. She said people are being branded, and there's branding, and then like, but the third time I ran into her, she said I've been branded, and she showed me, and I just thought, oh my god, like it's you know, and that obviously was like 12 years of indoctrination, and that was the culmination of it. But that for me also was just a big wake up call about how serious the situation was that she got herself into. But she went to the New York Times, and like a couple months after I first spoke to her and started recording the podcast, there she was on the front cover of the New York Times showing that brand. And very quickly, the FBI launches an investigation and the whole thing starts to crumble. Actually, as we were reporting the story, it really went from this organization that was like running full speed to the leaders have run off to Mexico to now they're arrested, and then they went to a trial. So it was quite a heady time, and just seeing how something can kind of completely crumble before your eyes.
Wow. So she was one of the original whistleblowers and helped basically get him put away, right? And now isn't he going to be in jail? He's there for over 100 years or something, yeah?
Yeah, I think it's 120 years in jail. I don't think he's coming out.
And other people were arrested too, I think, yeah?
Yeah, there was a number of co-conspirators. I think three of the others are serving prison time. Two are under probation, kind of house arrest. Everyone else pleaded guilty. And are facing like between, I think, 12 months and 5 years in prison.
Wow, it's so interesting. All right, so in your investigations with cults, with both these podcasts, I guess, with Sidhu and with Nexium, what was the most interesting thing or scary thing or, that you uncovered for you personally?
I mean, one of the things, especially doing the Nexium podcast and after that came out, was so many people came forward with stories, similar stories of being involved in a cult. I didn't realize the epidemic of cults that existed. I had heard about the high profile ones and the big cases that kind of everyone knew about, but there's so many rinky dink versions of exactly the same thing, and they're all cookie cutter versions. You know, they all run by the same playbook. They all have a charismatic leader. They use the same kind of tools of pressure and indoctrination. And usually there's a sexual component to it, and often a violent and abusive component to it. But the like scary thing to me was that often, you know, sometimes it was 10 people living out in the woods somewhere, like in the Rocky Mountains, or, you know, and it would never get any attention. So that to me was wild. Like, I literally just got dozens and dozens of emails of people. And then there was a couple times there were cases that we thought we might look into. And I started to be sort of so unsurprised. I mean, it's just back to that cookie cutter part of it. It's like every one of these things just runs the same way. To me, when I got to the Sidhu stuff, that was novel in a sense, because of what we talked about before. It's a surprising structure in terms of how they use the coercion, because the kids are already you don't have to indoctrinate them. They're already part of the program. They're stuck there. I mean, there is an indoctrination that happens, but it's really the parents that you have to dupe. So that's the thing. I mean, and then the other part of it is like, it's just the reason that they're so prolific, and the thing that I've come to appreciate is how the kind of universal human fallibility that you know, the cult experts say, and I do believe that, like, not every person could be sucked into every cult, but every person at the right stage of their life could be taken advantage of by a cult-like organization. It'd have to be that right mix of a moment of disruption in your life, a moment of change, a moment of searching, and then the right person, the right organization comes along and scoops you up. And I really, truly do believe that there's nothing deficient or exceptional about the people that get drawn into these groups. I just think that, like, it's wrong place, it's wrong time. Obviously, some people are more vulnerable to it. But I do, you know, just the fact that these organizations have existed for so long and keep popping up in so many iterations speak to that kind of error in our hardwiring that makes us vulnerable to these kinds of groups.
I think that's such an important comment because, you know, I sometimes watch these documentaries or listen to podcasts or think about what I've been through. And I look at the victims and sometimes I'm like, these people are so smart. How could they have fallen for this? How could they not answer these questions with a real answer? And I get so frustrated. And then I think about my experience and I'm like, but I didn't know at the time and I didn't know why I was doing it. And I thought these people were my family. I thought that they were my sisters, my brothers, the people that loved me, the people that cared about me. They were investing the time in me that no one else was. And everyone else had given up on me or, you know, whatever I, you know, did in my head to make sense of it. And then when you take a step back, I see that those similar qualities in the people that I'm watching. So I see them fumble through questions from journalists now, and they're like, but how could you have been in that cult? Or why don't you have an answer for these things? And they kind of are like, well, I don't know. I know why they don't know. It's just because you didn't know how to get out of it. You don't even know who you were at that stage almost. And a very smart person can get sucked in and not even realize it just because you want to be part of something more. You want to be a better person and you don't realize how dangerous it can be, right?
Totally. Totally. It can come from very good intentions.
Yeah, right. So, all right. So what are you investigating next that we can look for?
So I actually going to surprising turn of events, I ended up taking over the kind of day-to-day operation of the podcast studio where I made The Lost Kids. So I'm now kind of overseeing USG Audio in a more of an exec producer role. So I'm not doing as much on the ground stuff, but we just released a really a beautiful podcast, a beautifully crafted podcast about a really intense subject, but about a hate crime in Chicago in the 90s. But it's kind of part memoir, part investigation about this hate crime that occurred against a young black boy that was sort of going to the white side of town to get air for his tires for his bike and is beaten into a coma. And basically overnight, it becomes a national news story, but quickly flips into the story about reconciliation and forgiveness. And the host that was in his 20s at the time and is himself black and from the south side of Chicago and is like, what the fuck's going on here? This doesn't make any sense. Like, why are we talking about reconciliation? This kid's about to die. And he investigates the story at the time and uncovers a fascinating network of power underneath that's operating. The guy, the main kid that was charged with beating up this kid was actually the son of a very powerful boss who people have alleged is a mafia boss in Chicago. And he was paying off or pressuring leaders of the black churches to preach reconciliation and to turn this story into one about kumbaya and let's hold hands together. And it was very effective in pivoting the media. Anyways, it's a long-winded pitch of that series, but I highly recommend taking a listen to it. It's called You Didn't See Nothing. But we have a whole slate of podcasts coming out and stuff that I'm very excited about.
Great. Okay. And where can they find this podcast?
You find it, you know, wherever you get your podcasts. After they listen to your podcast, I'm sure it's up, on Apple or Stitcher or Spotify. It's all available. But it's USG Audio. So we actually have a channel now that if you just punch in USG Audio, our whole slate will pop up and you can kind of scroll through it.
Terrific. Okay, thank you so much. I so appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Misunderstood podcast with host Rachel Yucatel, executive producer Kelly Brink. If you have an episode suggestion or would like to reach out for collaboration and sponsorship opportunities, email us at infomisunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's infomisunderstoodpodcast, all one word, @gmail.com. Be sure to like and subscribe everywhere you get your podcasts and leave us a 5-star rating and review because it helps the show so much. Watch full videos of each and every episode of Misunderstood on YouTube at Misunderstood Podcast. See you next time.